Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
The Dakota Access Oil Pipeline is something that's been argued over for years, but just recently, the clash between protesters and the builders turned violent.
We begin today's show with an update on the fight by Native Americans to stop the proposed $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline.
Today, the standoff at Standing Rock. Native Americans protest a massive oil pipeline in North Dakota.
Yesterday, North Dakota looked more like a war zone than the site of a protest over the construction of a pipeline.
In the U.S., Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and her running mate have had warrants issued for their arrest in the state of North Dakota.
The group behind the pipeline says that it will help enhance energy independence for the United States. They say it will bring $150 million in taxes to state and local governments.
A new video shows journalist Aaron Schrody apparently being shot by a rubber bullet while conducting an interview at the protest site near Cannonball, North Dakota.
Hundreds of thousands of people are checking in at Standing Rock Indian Reservation via Facebook. Many of them, actually, as you've noticed, aren't anywhere near that exact spot.
The Dakota Access Pipeline, a $3.7 billion investment, will carry approximately 470,000 barrels of oil daily from the North Dakota Bakken region in the northwest corner of the state to Patoka, Illinois. At 1,172 miles in length, it will cross 50 counties in four states. And according to its builder, Energy Transfer Partners, the pipeline is scheduled to be finished by the end of 2016. The pipeline isn't even finished yet, and it already has a history. After a route was proposed and rejected in 2014 to cross the Missouri River north of Bismarck, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers approved a route that would allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross the Missouri River north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. There has been a lot of debate as to whether or not the Army Corps officially communicated with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and now many are protesting the pipeline's construction because the current route will interrupt culturally significant gravesites, and it could also pose as a threat to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe's water. Energy Transfer Partners said the pipeline will generate over 8,000 local jobs, it will bring in millions of dollars locally, and it will increase our energy independence from other nations. But how much does this really mean when so many people are worried for the well-being of the Standing Rock Sioux? Last weekend, three reporters from Radio K's Real College podcast took a road trip to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in Fort Yates, North Dakota. Here's Emily LePain with more.
You know, it's to me, it's like government-supported terrorism.
That's Ann Dunn, an Ojibwe native from the Leech Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota. If you flip back through the history books, this sort of conduct isn't necessarily new. It seems to be a common theme since Europeans first had contact with Native Americans in the late 15th century, after Christopher Columbus first sailed the ocean blue in 1492. But why has the Dakota Access Pipeline blown up into such a big issue? Dunn says it's because it's an invasion, and more importantly, it's to protect the water.
I came to support this effort against this invasion. I'm also here because, like many, many people, I'm concerned about the quality of our water in defending this good mother who has done so much for us, provides us with everything.
Dunn's mother used to say that this fight isn't just about us. It's about the wildlife. It's about the Green Nations.
All they want to do is help us. The Green Nations don't make war on people. They don't make war on monkeys. They just want to help us, and they provide shade, building material, that's obvious. And you know what? They provide beauty and magic and music.
But this fight isn't just about the environment or protesting a pipeline for the people at Standing Rock and the Sacred Stone or Oshedi Sakowin camps. This is also about making their voices heard. Russell Eaglebear from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, one of the seven council fires of the Lakota people, is from the Standing Rock Reservation, and he says that consultation of federal agencies with Native and Indigenous peoples is very misrepresented.
For example, I'm the tribal historic preservation officer, and we handle two levels of consultation.
One level is government to government. So, for example, the federal agency is supposed to meet with tribal leaders to let them know what's going to happen with the Dakota Access Pipeline and to get their approval.
That didn't happen.
And on the second level, the federal agency is supposed to check that the proposed project would not disturb any cultural or sacred sites.
They didn't do that because all of it's done on private land. The only connection we had is on the federal land. When they're going to cross federal land, they have to consult with us. Well, if they call my office, for example, and they don't get through to me, they call it consultation. And that's not right. You know, it's not right.
But both Eagle Bear and Dunn echoed a similar sentiment. Eventually, this pipeline will fail. And that's what they're truly afraid of.
It's all here, and we need to take care of it, because if we don't, the next generation will have a lot less, and the next generation will have a lot less.
Dunn also says that she sees any further investment in the oil industry as kind of crazy.
It's going to be obsolete, and it should be. I think we all need to get on the alternative energy wagon, and just whatever plan that we make, what even in our small daily activities, we have to start remembering the seven generations, those that are coming, are going to need these resources too. And maybe they won't need oil, but they're certainly going to need water.
Some of those serving as water protectors at Standing Rock are veterans. But after honorably serving their country overseas, many veterans are upset with the treatment of their people here in the United States. Take Sky, a Marine veteran from Fairbanks, Alaska, and part of the Koyukon Athabascan tribe.
I went on a mission in Iraq, and they had sent me to go get drinking water.
They were doing road repairs, and they had run out of water. So Sky and one other person were sent down a road riddled with IEDs.
So we were basically going down the road where, you know, it was a suicide mission. And our truck got hit by an IED, and it was a miracle that, like, there was no shrapnel. We still have our body parts, you know, and we make it back. And it just goes to show, like, they used drinking water as an excuse that was important enough to put our lives on the line, and you know, we did that for our country. Why isn't drinking water important in our own country? It's basically the livelihood of all the people in this area.
Hi, this is my granddaughter, Nikki Gunsekwe.
Hello.
Little otter woman.
Hello.
Hello, say howdy.
I'm just talking to your grandma. I'm just asking her a few questions.
Yeah. She's not going to... She thinks somebody wants to steal me all the time.
Oh, no. She's all yours.
Yep. She doesn't believe you. I guess you look like a grandma thief.
I guess I do.
A granny nabber.
According to Dunn, Dakota Access has made it clear that they are not willing to back down, that they will go through with the pipeline regardless of the growing resistance to the project. Despite this, and despite the clashes with law enforcement, the people peacefully assembled at Standing Rock, both Native and non-Native alike, won't go down without a fight.
They tried to intimidate the people. These people are not intimidated, but they are going to stand up to this. They say, this is the last stand. It's going to stop here. The last stand. Of course, I can't. I don't know the outcome. I know what I'd like for the outcome to be. Of course, I have no idea what's going to happen.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePain in Standing Rock, North Dakota.
As three non-Native journalists on a Native American reservation, we were scared at times of stepping on toes. However, in a movement like the one against the Dakota Access Pipeline, allies, both media and otherwise, are extremely important. Reporter Jacob Maldonado Medina has the story.
There's a lot at stake at Standing Rock.
After hundreds of years of oppression, genocide, the culture is alive, the spirituality is alive, and it's very strong.
That's Bob Cohn. He was working on a documentary at Standing Rock.
And it's amazing how resilient You know, and I think they're really an example to all of us about resilience, resistance. And we have to learn a lot. That's the thing. We need to learn, and we've got a huge amount to learn from them.
Mm-hmm. Cohen started his career in media as a reporter for CNN in Zimbabwe, covering the struggle for independence from Britain. Here at Standing Rock, he sees something similar.
It's real. You can touch colonialism and settler colonialism. And we don't talk about colonialism in America, but this is what it's about. And, you know, history sometimes can seem a little abstract and something you can't touch. You just read in the books. But this is living history. You know, you're actually touching what America, or the myth of America, is built upon.
To Cohen, colonialism is so palpable and real, and yet the media doesn't always acknowledge colonialism by name.
You know, we have created a sort of a false narrative that has been fed to us through education, through films, through culture. And so people don't have an understanding. It's also a conceptual thing. It's not something that most people understand and can relate to at all. So there's a whole lot of learning and relearning that has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Cohen isn't the only one who felt the sort of dissatisfaction with the media. Patience Alanga and Justin are two young reporters from the Black Liberation Project. To them, social media is the way to get the whole truth.
How do you guys feel from what you've seen the media, like how good of a job or bad of a job has the media done covering this whole Standing Rock protest?
Well, I think that's an interesting question because most of what I've seen of what has been happening here has been through Twitter and through the followers that, you know, I follow on social media. And so my go-to has been like other social media accounts that are either already on the ground because the news and media has not been doing a great job of really displaying what is happening here in North Dakota.
I'd say similar to what Patience said, most of the time when I pay attention to media, it's people on Twitter or even Unicorn Ride, who are from Minneapolis, that we actually used to organize with. And so mainstream media, I haven't seen a lot of stuff. I really tend to ignore it. So most of my news has been coming from people on Twitter, independent news sources. So I'd say if you're asking about mainstream media, they've done a poor job. But other than that, like, the movement has found ways to build autonomy and solidarity through other forms of media, which I think is powerful. I'm interested in coalition building, and I think the Black struggle and Indigenous struggle are tied up within each other. And so I think it's important to see how we can build coalitions between movements, between the Black Lives Matter movement and the American Indian movement, or the, you know, No DAPL movement. And so I'm interested to see how people here are organizing, building power, and how we can bring these movements together.
Much of the media is quick to report on the protests that take a turn for the violent and leave out a lot of stories of peaceful prayers at the camps.
What about the media? There's obviously a lot of press here, myself included. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that, with what you've seen in the news, how do you feel that the press has done? Have they done their job in covering this?
So far, the media, as long as y'all guys are covering that we are unarmed, we are protectors, we are here, just here to protect the water. We're not here to pick a fight. We're not here to start a war. They're over there just for war. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessary.
That's Andre Wensi. He's from McLeod, Oklahoma, with the Kickapoo tribe. While media coverage of the camps is an issue, there's other problems within the camp.
You know, they just drop their water bottles and they don't pick up their trash and they just treat it like a state fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you've been to a state fair, you see trash everywhere by the end of the night. This is not a fair. I've heard that this is a sacred area. And my grandma told me that if it's somebody's home, you treat it with respect.
So what exactly does it take to be a good ally? Jerry from Fort Collins has a few ideas.
Well, talk about it, of course, is the number one thing. Spread the word. Let everyone know what's going on here. I encourage everyone to send an email, text, letter, phone call to President Obama, their congressman, the governor of this state. You just flood their phones with positive messages of support for these people, that even if you don't show up, there's so much you can do from home. You can check in to GoFundMe or any of these sites and, you know, just send them money, any kind of help, Amazon.
Just ask questions. Find elders. Elders know a lot. I mean, they're pretty easy to identify, you know, and ask them questions, and they'll tell you. They'll tell you, real bluntly, because that's just the way it is. They may sound rude about it, but you gotta respect them.
Right.
And they're like that all around the world. Blunt and, you know, just short, sweet, and to the point. Ask permission if you're going to do something that you think is questionable or you think is right. Even though if you're 100% sure it's right, it's always good to have permission to have that 100%.
That's Wensi again. By asking questions, we can learn a lot from Native culture, a culture that's very much alive. Herwin Armstrong was the last person I talked to before we left camp. He's a Native man, and he thinks that there's a lot people can take from Native ways.
Like everybody says, once you come here, you're being drawn back again. It's like a spiritual thing. And people that come around all the time, they always say that, you know, something draws them over. It's because of the sacredness of here, the spirituality of here. It draws people back over all the time. And we're all here for one common thing, and that's to try to stop the pipeline. Prayer and commonality and solidarity, yeah. That's what we put forth from the Lakota people. And that's prayer and compassion and loving each other, mm-hmm. and caring for each other. That's our nature, Lakota people.
Reporting for Radio K from Standing Rock, this is Jacob Maldonado Medina.
Most of the news regarding Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline has focused on the demonstrations, the marches, and the cop-on-protester action. Reporter Emily Allen, that's me, learned that not everyone involved has participated in these protests. Instead, many say they're making their impact from the camps themselves.
My name is Washdewi Young, and I am from here on Standing Rock.
Meet Washday, who has been at Sacred Stone Camp since August. During our stay in North Dakota, we visited two camps on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in Fort Yates, Sacred Stone, which has been open since April, and Ocheti Shakawan, one of the larger camps that popped up in August after there was an increase in protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Washday and her family have been at Sacred Stone Camp since August.
I've been here with my family, my husband works, and I have four kids, and we've all been out here. I was working at Sitting Bull College, and I quit to be out here full time, and I sew ribbon skirts for women that don't have them, because it's traditional protocol. Like, anytime we have a gathering, we wear skirts.
When Washday and her family first arrived at the camp, she said they had been living in tents. Now they've moved on to yurts, or, as they're called in Mongolia, their country of origin, gurs. Yurts are round, dome-shaped homes, and they're portable due to their compressible lattice walls.
They are really, really comfortable. They have we have sheep's wool for insulation, and all the ropes are made out of horsehair and canvas, so everything comes from the earth or animals.
Of course, yurts don't have everything. Washday mentioned that she still uses and has opened up her home in Fort Yates to others for showering and laundry.
I have a home in Fort Yates, which is about 23 miles south of here, and I have families from Tennessee and North Carolina staying with me that came to support us, and they quit their jobs, and they've been allies and supporters, and I've opened my home to anyone that needs to, you know, do laundry or shower or anything like that. So it's kind of like a home base, and this is kind of like being on the front line out here to ensure that it's not, you know, the pipeline isn't built or doesn't happen.
Not everyone has an off-camp home base. This is Huey, who arrived to Standing Rock from Portland, Oregon, around the same time that Washday arrived with her family. Huey is staying at Ocheti Shakwan, the second camp we visited.
My name is Sam Huey Nelson. Huey's my nickname.
Neither is Huey staying in a yurt. Right now, he's actually living in a shed.
It's a storage room for our cook, our traditional cook. But my wife came here to visit me, and it got too cold in our tent, so we moved in here and then just basically took it over, moved everything out, and made a little apartment out of it, you might say, for everybody, because a lot of people stay in here a lot. It gets a little too cold for them.
Huey's shed was definitely warmer than a tent, but it didn't have a real roof. When I was there, I noticed that they had just covered the top with a tarp. Another thing that caught my attention was the corn. Huey had corn hanging from the front of his shed like holiday lights.
And people hang corn from the front, you say?
Yeah, those were students, kids that come around. They dried it, hung it, be used for all different type of things.
A third thing that caught my eye was Huey's door. While Huey was gone for a brief job interview in Minnesota, someone had painted his door. It wasn't graffiti or anything. It was an actual painting, a very vibrant, very colorful work, a masterpiece that must have taken a lot of time and thought.
You like my door? Yeah. Well, I thought it was a hippie door when I came back. So I'm sort of an old hipster from Portland, Oregon, you know, so I sort of liked it. But then a pastor and his wife drove by, and he knew the artist.
As it is with most masterpieces, the bottom of the door was signed, but it was a little hard to read the name.
Matika Fields.
Is that the name, Matika? We couldn't quite figure it out.
Can I look it up?
Yeah. I was going to look it up, but we don't get internet or nothing around here, so I haven't been able to be a...
Turns out it wasn't just anybody who painted that door. After getting back to Minneapolis from North Dakota, I looked at the name from the bottom of the painting, and I discovered that it was actually Yadika Fields. Yadika Fields is a Native American painter and muralist of Cherokee Creek and Osage descent from Sweetwater, Oklahoma. Although we didn't run into Yadika while we were at Standing Rock, we did run into a lot of rules, the biggest three being no drugs, no alcohol, and no weapons. However, Ocheti Shakwan and Sacred Stone are two very big, highly populated camps.
Sometimes there's thousands of us here, 7,000, 8,000 at a time. Hard to monitor that many type of people, but it happens, you know.
To officially be allowed to report from the camp, to carry around our recorders and to ask questions as members of the press, we had to go to a media tent to get official Ocheti Shakwan press passes. We were also given a set of rules. We were not allowed to get any ambient noise. We were told to watch out for side glances and suspicious stares. We were not allowed to report from the school tent, the cafeteria tent, or the medical tent. And we were also told not to record any ceremonies or prayer.
Every morning you wake up to prayer, you know, because it's on the mic, it's everywhere around us. So we wake up to it every morning and we go to sleep every night listening to the announcer pray, sing, remind us why we're here, you know.
Maybe it's all the tight press rules that have scared journalists away from reporting on the camps. Or maybe the protests outside the camps just seem more exciting. Either way, the camps themselves haven't really received a lot of coverage. There's so much that I wouldn't know had I not experienced the camp myself. The rules, the prayers, and the people. For Real College Podcast, this has been Emily Allen. That's all for Real College Podcast this week. Radio K's Real College Podcast is edited by Patrick Sharkey. The show is also produced by Max Fuller, Emily LePain, Jacob Maldonado Medina, and Emily Allen. Thanks to Jacob Maldonado Medina, Emily LePain, and Emily Allen for reporting this week's story on Standing Rock. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.